Fascinating discussion with our special guest tonight, Dr. Marcelo Gleiser. His book, A Tear at the Edge of Creation. He's also the author of The Dancing Universe, and we'll be back with him in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Marcelo, let's go back just for a moment to the asymmetry of time before we go to the asymmetry of matter. And as you talk about the Big Bang, can you explain that for us too, in terms, because I've got, and probably always will have, a difficult time perceiving what happened.
Well,
let's get your take on that.
Right. I hope you should feel okay about that. You know, you're not alone. it's not an easy thing to swallow, because what happens is this. When we talk about the Big Bang, right, immediately people picture in their heads an explosion like a bomb,
yes.
Right? That happens in a point, right? So you have like the point where the bomb goes off, and then you have a bunch of shrapnel stuff that flies away from that explosive point, right? That's the notion. They say, oh, okay, so the Big Bang happened in some point in space and stuff started to fly off that point. And that is not the idea, okay? So what is the idea then? Well, it's a little trickier. The idea is that there's not stuff flying off from a point where the explosion happened, but that space itself, it's stretching outwards like a rubber balloon, okay? So when a bomb explodes and you have stuff flying off, you're assuming that space is sort of, you know, like the stage where things are happening, so it's mm-hmm. fixed and not moving, right? And everything is flying across space. Well, here the picture is different. The picture is basically saying that things are flying off because they're being carried away by the stretchy space, just like a cork, in a sense, floating on a river is being carried away by a current, right? So when we talk about the expansion of the universe, which is really the most important notion of the Big Bang, what we mean by that is not like that we are expanding, we people are expanding, although some of us may after a certain age and it gets harder not to expand, but or the solar system is expanding, like the distances between the sun and the earth is growing. That's not what we mean. It's really at very, very, very large distances between galaxies, like millions of years apart, millions of light years apart, sorry, that these effects are actually happening. And what's going on is, like, again, think of the galaxies, each galaxy like our Milky Way, as a cork floating on this big river. And this river is space, and it's space itself that it's stretching and carrying the galaxies away. So the Big Bang was not sort of an explosion that happened in one point, but, and here comes the weird idea, is an explosion that happens in every point. Okay, so there is no center, like a boom place. Where
right. Maybe they shouldn't have called it the Big Bang. Maybe they should have said something else.
I know. The name is not good. And in fact, it was a joke. You know, what happened is that in 1948, when there are two theories going around. One was this idea that the universe started small and it's being expanding, which is the one that becomes the Big Bang. And the other one was called the steady state theory that basically said that the universe never had a beginning, will never have an end, that it's sort of a static thing that doesn't really change in time. And the guy who invented this theory is a guy called Fred Hoyle. And he was British, and he was in a radio program from the BBC. And the people asked him, what about this other idea that the universe is changing in time? And they said, oh, that Big Bang idea is just crazy. So he was basically making fun of the Big Bang model, but the name stuck. And now it's the Big Bang. And unfortunately, or fortunately, it depends who you talk to, we know now that the steady state idea is not right, and is the Big Bang is the one that actually makes sense.
Okay, now, I can perceive the floating cork on water. I can see that. I can visualize that. But where in the heck did all this matter come from? All this physical stuff that we see throughout the universe?
Right. So, okay. So, basically, we have to go back to the E equals MC squared formula, the one that Einstein came up with in 1905, that said that you can actually think of matter as just another form of energy, okay, sort of a you feel, and it's like a coagulated form of energy, right? Concentrated form of energy. So you might as well ask, where is all this energy coming from? Where is what's going on? So as you go backwards in time, right? If you play this movie backwards now, all these galaxies and stars and everything, they start to get squished into very, very small volumes, okay? Now, when you do that, when you squeeze matter into very small volumes, you heat it up, okay? And heat is the enemy of structure, of stuff that is organized, okay? When you heat things up, things break apart, right? And so, for example, when you put lots of atoms in a small volume and you heat it up, then the heat is going to break those atoms apart. And instead of having an atom, you're going to have electrons flying around and protons flying around and things like that. So as you go backwards in time, instead of having stars or molecules or atoms, you have just particles, the components of matter, zigzapping around in space. We call this stage the primal soup, the primordial soup, okay? So when we talk about the beginning of things, we're not really thinking galaxies and people here. We are talking about little particles, okay, squeezed in a very small volume. And you may say, okay, fine, but where did these particles come from, really, which is what you're asking. Where is this coming from? Now, there is a little trick that goes on here, which is gravity is a very interesting force because it's an attractive force, as we know, and because of that, you can think of it as having negative energy, okay? And because it's attracting things and it makes things fall. So, for example, if you lift a rock off the ground, it's not moving, but you know that if you let go, it's going to fall down to the ground.
Right.
And this kind of energy, which is not moving, but it's stored, which is it's called potential energy. Okay, this we know that if you let the stone fall down, it's going to fall down. It's going to move to the ground. This potential energy we calculate it as being negative energy. Okay, so why is this important? Well, because the universe is full of gravitational energy. Okay, which is negative, but it's also full of matter, which is positive, the mc squared part. And in the balance, you can actually have a balance where the energy, the total energy of the two is zero. On the one hand, you have gravity with negative energy, and then the other hand, you have matter with positive energy. You add the two, and you get zero. So the universe is a zero-sum game. You know, it's the only free lunch that you have, in the sense that you get everything out of essentially nothing because you add the two, and you get zero. Okay, so that's the mystery of things. When you go back in time, the universe is so squeezed into such a small volume that its gravitational energy, remember when I talked before about the gravity as being the curvature of space? Well, yes. You have so much of it in there that you have a tremendous amount of this negative energy stored, okay? And from that, you can create all this positive energy, all this mass. So in the beginning, you basically had a universe which was just squeezed space, just matter waiting to happen. And out of this event is matter pops out of it, and that's what the Big Bang is.
And you also subscribe to the theory of multiverses too, multi-universes?
Well, you know, that's a tough one, right? I mean, I kind of like the idea because a lot of the theories of modern cosmology sort of suggest that that's possible. Now, what the heck is the multiverse, right? I mean, if the universe were not complicated enough, I mean, here we go.
We have many more, maybe.
Yes, exactly. So the multiverse is essentially the notion that the universe is not all there is. Our universe is not all there is, that there is actually a huge number, possibly even an infinite number of other universes out there in this kind of infinite atemporal, that is, there's no time out there, thing called the multiverse. Now, how do I visualize this? The way I think about this, and this is clearly just an image, and of course, it has its limitations, but it may be useful for some people. You think of having a giant pan where you have bubbling water, right? And so this bubbling water is your multiverse. It's there all over the place. It's bubbling everywhere. And once in a while, a bubble pops out, okay? And this bubble popping, you know, like the witch's potion, you know, and this bubble that pops out is this universe. And it could be another universe. And different universes in this multiverse can have completely different properties. They can have different laws of nature. They can have different particles. And so the way we look at this nowadays is that our universe, the universe where we live, that has been around for about 14 billion years, where the electron has a certain mass and atoms do stuff and electromagnetic waves do different things and light travels at 186,000 miles per second. Our universe is just one out of many. And it's the one that has the right properties for matter to organize itself into more and more complex structures as time goes by, so that after 14 billion years, here we are talking about these things in coast-to-coast AM.
I love it. Okay, so let's move into, I can't wait till I start asking you what you think we are and why we're here. Wait till we get to those. The asymmetry of matter, what does that mean?
All right, the asymmetry of matter. Okay, so this is a little more palpable than the time and the Big Bang and the multiverse. Maybe some of your listeners have read Dan Brown's novel called Angels and Demons. In that novel, right? Very famous, big bestseller, was a movie, right? In that story, basically the bad guys, they wanted to build a bomb to blow up the Vatican and kill the Pope and all the cardinals and essentially destroy the hierarchy of the Catholic Church. Now, how would they do that? That bomb they wanted to build was an antimatter bomb. And when you talk about antimatter, people immediately start thinking about very esoteric sci-fi stuff. And it turns out the antimatter is not esoteric or sci-fi. You can make it in the laboratory. And in fact, there is this laboratory in Switzerland where this big machine called the Large Hadron Collider is, where we make antimatter all the time.
Right.
Now, what is antimatter? Well, it's simply the following. According to the laws of physics, and in particular of particle physics, which is the physics that studies the basic building blocks of matter, like electrons, etc., every particle of matter has a sister particle of antimatter. So, for example, the electron, which is the little particle that moves about the nucleus of the atom, has a positron. So the electron has negative electric charge. The positron, as the name says, is going to have positive electric charge. So the antiparticles usually have the opposite electric charge of the particles. Okay, it's sort of like a mirror world, where if you have something which is one charge in our world, in the antimatter world, you'd have the opposite charge. Now, according to the laws of particle physics, there should be as much particles as antiparticles in the world. They should come out in equal footing. Now, we know that's not the case because if there were as much matter as antimatter in the universe, we wouldn't be here. Why wouldn't we be here? Well, because of the Dan Brown bomb in the Vatican. Essentially, when matter and antimatter connect, touch each other, they immediately disintegrate into very high energy radiation. They really go bang. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if you find your anti-George Norrie in the street, do not shake hands with him because the whole of the United States will vaporize immediately. Okay,
that's all we need.
So essentially, antimatter, if it were as popular or as common as matter, the universe would be a very, very different place. Which means that there is much more antimatter in the universe, there is much more matter in the universe than antimatter, which begs the question, why? Why is there an asymmetry where somehow the universe in its history picked up matter and sort of despised antimatter so that antimatter nowadays is rarer? Well, there are many explanations, possible explanations for that, but the point is that it has to be like that. You have to have this asymmetry that breaks this perfect relationship between matter and antimatter, which was predicted by particle physics. So that's the asymmetry of matter, that there is more matter than antimatter in the universe, and because of that, we are here. We wouldn't be here if they appeared at the same amount. So that's...
All right. And the next one is asymmetry of life.
Okay, so then we move to more palpable waters still, which is the notion that, well, where does life come from, right? So I always say that there are three big questions in science that used to be questions that religion used to deal with, but that now are cutting edge questions of science. So one of them we discussed is the origin of the universe, the other or the Big Bang. The other one is the origin of matter, where does matter come from? And the other one is the origin of life. Actually, there are four. And the fourth one is the origin of mind. Where does mind come from? But let's leave that one for later, maybe.
That's the grand finale, isn't it?
Yeah. So the origin of life is an incredibly complicated question, right? Because if you think about it, you say, well, what are we made of, really? Right? Well, we are made of atoms. Right, just like the Greeks said, right? So we have atoms, we have carbon, we have hydrogen, we have oxygen, all these basic chemical elements. By the way, may I open a parenthesis here, which is a very pretty one. If people are wondering, well, where is the carbon and the oxygen and the nitrogen, all these chemical elements, where do they come from? They all come from stars. So when people say that we are stardust, it's for real. We really are made of stardust. So all the chemical elements that we have in our bodies really were part of a star 5 billion years ago. I think that's just a beautiful image that brings us really much closer to the universe than we can possibly think. But anyway, so we have these chemicals out there that make us up. The question is, how do they organize into complicated molecules? Right, the organic molecules, the molecules that make up living things, and at what point they decide that they are a living system, right, that they become able to absorb energy from the environment so they essentially can metabolize or they can eat, and most importantly, they can reproduce, which is the signature of life. So how does chemistry become biology, right? How does the non-living become the living? Now, that's a really deep, fascinating question. And we know this. We know that life on Earth is about 4.5 billion years of age, according to our latest measurements. Mm-hmm. And life on Earth appeared about 3.5 billion years ago. Okay, and the key point about life is that life also carries with it a very fundamental asymmetry. Okay, now, what is this asymmetry? Okay, so let's think a little bit about the biochemistry of life without falling asleep here. So essentially, what we have is this. Think of proteins, right? We all need proteins. We eat proteins. Without proteins, we wouldn't be alive. Now, proteins are very long. They are molecules which you can think as being very long chains.
We'll pick that up, Marcelo, when we come right back. Just fascinating. This show is going almost as fast as the speed of light. We'll be back. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Dr. Marcelo Gleiser right here on Coast to Coast AM. A tear at the edge of creation. More to talk with him about, though, when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. There we are, Marcelo. Before the break, we were talking about another aspect of the multiverse and also our existence of life in general. Go ahead.
So I was mentioning or trying to explain that life also at its core has a very fundamental asymmetry, because the main theme in the book that I discuss is that our search for symmetries has been wonderful, has borne a lot of fruit, but we should be also paying attention to the asymmetries of the universe, which is where actually things happen. So I talked about the asymmetry of matter and why having more matter than antimatter is ultimately responsible for us being here. And now we're talking about life, that life at its very core, at the biochemistry, the level of the molecules of living things, also has an asymmetry. And here is how it goes. Well, it's fundamental for life to have proteins. Proteins are part of every living thing.
Mm-hmm.
All its metabolism depends on proteins. And proteins, if you want, you can think of them as very long molecules, like a train. You know, think of a train with all the different cars in it. And each one of these cars is an amino acid. That's the name of the molecules. Okay, so think of these long chains of amino acids. That's what a protein is. Now, amino acids, they are molecules that have this interesting property, which is just like the human hand. If you look at your left hand and you look at your right hand, they are very different. If you try to superimpose one on top of the other, you see that one is going to have a thumb pointing one way, the other one is going to have the thumb pointing the other way. And we call this the handedness, obviously, because it comes from the hands. And there is actually a word in Greek for that, which comes, it's called chirality. Now, it turns out that just like our hands, these amino acids also come in two shapes, the left-handed shape and the right-handed shape. And just like our hands, one is the mirror image of the other. Okay.
Right.
Now, so if you go to the lab, so you're a synthetic chemist, you know, you go work in the laboratory and you're going to make an amino acid. Let's say you make an amino acid called alanine. Okay, it's the name of one amino acid. And you go there and you make it and you make a solution and you're going to find that you get 50% of it left-handed and 50% of it right-handed. So it's a 50-50 kind of mix and you always get that in the lab. However, when you go to living systems, be it a plant, a bacteria, or a person, and you look at the amino acids that make up the proteins of these living systems, they are always left-handed, all of them, no exception. So there is somehow life selects a specific hand for these molecules. And without that, without this selectivity, without this handedness of life, it would be impossible for proteins to do their work, which is to essentially create and organize all the chemical reactions that make a living system sustain its life. And furthermore, if you look at how systems reproduce, which is the other part of living systems, right? We always reproduce through genetical division. The molecules that are responsible for that, which are called DNA molecules, they are also asymmetric. Instead of being left-handed, the sugars that make up the DNAs, they are right-handed. So there is a very fundamental asymmetry of life, and it's there, and it's very important for life to be here. So that's the other asymmetry I was going to talk about. Now, okay, why is this important for us? Well, it's important because if you now go and you look at the history of life on Earth, okay, or even think about the history of how life appeared in the universe. Well, you had to have a very special universe that had the right properties for the Big Bang to bang, essentially, for it to develop all the different particles. And then you have to have more matter than antimatter, another asymmetry. And then you had to have stars forming. Our sun is a star. It made its planets about 4.5 billion years ago. The sun and the planets of the solar system were born all together, and the Earth happens to be this special place where it's warm enough for water to be liquid, right? And in this sort of watery planet, those chemicals, those amino acids, combined to form the first living creatures, right? And so then you start studying the history of life on Earth, you know, from 3.5 billion years ago to nowadays. And you realize that complicated creatures, complicated animals, only appeared on the last 500 million years. So for 3 billion years of the history of life on Earth, all we had here were like bacteria-like things, very simple one-cellular organisms. And this is kind of an amazing thing. So only in the last 500 million years, more complicated stuff started to happen. And us, humans, we've only been here for 200,000 years, which is a drop of water when you think about how long this planet existed. So even though we behave as we are the masters of the place, we're really the newcomers here, you know? And Why is this important? Well, it's important because as you look at the history of life on Earth, and you look at how it went from not having life to having these chemicals combining to form the first primitive living things, to having these amoeba-like things dominate for 3 billion years, eventually more complex life forms. And then we have the dinosaurs, right, that existed for about 150 million years, and then they were extinct. And I can tell you about how that happened in a second. And then eventually the mammals developed and organized and became more complex, and eventually we are here. If you trace this whole history, you figure out that to go from simple to complex, all sorts of accidents happened, right? Then I remember at the beginning of the show, you said something, well, could I really say we are the result of an accident? And I'm saying, yes, we are the result of a series of accidents, right? Several of them. So that if I were like God, you know, which I'm not, obviously, but if I could go backwards in time to the beginning of how Earth appeared, and I could tweak things a little bit, the history of life here would be completely different, and we wouldn't be here. What does that tell you? Well, when I say that to people, they say, well, that's so depressing. You know, basically, you're telling us that we are just the result of asymmetries, that we are just accidents, and so we are worthless, life is meaningless, I'm going to slit my throat. I'm like, no, stop, stop. It's exactly not that. What I'm saying is precisely the opposite. I'm saying that because we're rare, because we are the result of all these accidents, we are extremely precious and we are extremely important. And so I'm trying to actually put humanity at the center stage of creation once again, because we are rare creatures. We are able to think about things. And because of that, we have a very, very important mission ahead of us, which is we have to become the guardians of life. We have to be the ones that are going to make sure that this planet, which is an amazing place, stays here and that we can stay with it.
Well, that's a theory, I think, that is as plausible as any I've heard. Now, to get to that point, over all these years of studying and trying to, you know, wrestle with the question of who are we, where are we going, what does your gut tell you now about all this? How do you know you're right?
Well, you know, it's a good thing that you asked this question, because we have to make a difference between belief and science, in a sense, right? And I am betting in based on science. So my bet is pretty heavy, you know, and I know I can win. So, and the way it goes is like this. Take a look at our solar system, right? We look at our solar system, and there are magnificent worlds out there. You look at Saturn and its majestic rings, and Jupiter with its big red spot storm, which is much bigger than the Earth. And then you look at Mars getting closer to home. It's beautiful, it's spectacular, but all these worlds are barren, right? There is no life that we know of in any of them. If there's anything on Mars, it's going to be extremely simple life forms, and they'll live underground because Mars doesn't really have much of an atmosphere to speak of, so it has tremendous amounts of radiation that hit the surface, and complex life just cannot deal with that. So you look at our solar system and you realize that our planet, Earth, is really like Pandora, you know, from the Avatar movie. It is the place where...
It is Pandora. Yeah.
Exactly. It is Pandora. You know, the Pandora is a metaphor, obviously, for Earth and what's going on here, because it's a magical place. And then, nowadays, astronomy has evolved so much that you're able to look at other stars out there and see planets moving about those stars. Okay, so we now can actually see directly and indirectly planets revolving around other stars. And what we have seen so far is that there aren't many planets that look like Earth, like rocky, close enough to the star to be warm, but not very far to be too cold, so that if there is water, it's going to be liquid water. So Earth is not a very common planet. There certainly will be things like Earth out there, and if you ask me, do you believe in extraterrestrial life, I'll say definitely. I think that there will be simple life in other planets, But complex life, and in particular intelligent life, that's a whole other ball game. And I think that's going to be much more difficult to find. Can't tell you it doesn't exist or it does exist, but I can tell you it's going to be very hard to find intelligent civilizations out there, in spite of all the sightings that people have had of UFOs and all that stuff. You know, there's not a real hardcore piece of evidence for any of that.
And many sightings, for example, in your homeland.
That's right.
Many.
Yeah, the aliens must like Sambo, something like that. They like.
who could blame them, right?
I know, exactly. They like to go down there. But, you know, and when I say that, you know, I'm giving like a public lecture and I'm saying, look, you know, unfortunately, we don't really have any credible evidence that aliens have been here. People like roll their eyes and say, well, these scientists are such a pain in the neck. You know, they're such naysayers and they're negative about these things. And I say this, no one more than us would love to have this evidence, because after all, that's what we do for a living. Here we are thinking about these questions, you know. And so we would love to have aliens come and visit. We would love to know the answer. Is there intelligent life elsewhere in the universe? But we need real credible evidence that we can go to the lab, we can see it and say, yeah, this little piece of metal here really has been made in a completely different place. It's really not from here. Or some living thing that has a genetics which is not based on our genetics, a completely different kind of life form. And unfortunately, we don't have these, so we can't say that these things have happened. Which brings me to this point that being the case, we humans are very rare and very precious and very important, because we're thinking beings. So I always like to say that we are how the universe thinks about itself. We are the cosmic consciousness.
My spirituality, Marcelo, tells me that our purpose here is, you know, to reach perfection. You know, our bodies are mere shells. Our souls are the most important thing. Let's put that aside for a second, because that's a discussion that could go on forever. So let's put that aside. That's what I think we're here for, but that doesn't matter in this discussion. So if that's pushed out, spirituality, how you were raised, how I was raised, and in your various religions and mine, put that aside. Then we look at the big question of what's it all about? I mean, here I am interviewing you on a international radio program. You're a well-known physicist. You've written a great book, A Tear at the Edge of Creation. You know, we've all done successful things in our career. Many people who are listening have done great things in their own careers, or their family members, or they're just hard workers, and that's a success all by itself. I'm sure everybody every day takes a moment out of their day and just simply asks themselves the question, what am I here for? What is it? With spirituality taken out of the equation, what's that answer?
So that's a very, very good question. And I would start by answering, let's not take spirituality out of the equation. Let's leave it there, but let's maybe give it a different clothing. So we do not need to attach spirituality to a specific religion. You know, we can be spiritual beings without being Catholics and Jews and Muslims and Zen Buddhists. It's possible to actually have a very deep connectivity with the world we live in, which I call spirituality, and to be in awe with creation and with the beauty of nature, and hence feel that you're part of this big thing called the universe, and that makes you resonate in a different way, let's put it that way, which I would call a spiritual way, without believing in different kinds of supernatural gods, you know, because there are quite a few of them. If you ask a Hindu, it's going to be one thing. If you ask a Muslim, it's going to be another thing. If you ask a Maori Indian from New Zealand, it's going to be a different thing. But so we humans are deeply spiritual creatures, and the kind of science I'm proposing, okay, and this is also something that my partners in my National Public Radio blog, the NPR blog that you mentioned before, we are all scientists, and we are all very credible scientists, and we're all very spiritual people that actually speak against some scientists out there. There are the atheists, we call them the fundamentalist atheists, like Richard Dawkins and a bunch of others, that actually think that religion and religious belief is a form of delirium. We actually, delusion, right? The God delusion, yeah, is one of the books. And we actually don't subscribe to that at all. So I would say that there are two ways to deal with that, to think of this spirituality. One is at the individual level, you know, what you do in your life, the people you love, and how you help them become happy. You know, I think one of the most spiritual things you can do is make sure that the people around you are as happy as they can possibly be. The other one is this other notion that I'm trying to bring with my book, which is the spirituality of humanity itself, of the fact that we humans are extremely important in the big scheme of things because we are so rare and we are so unique. And so instead of being united because of wars, so they unite one tribe against another tribe in a war, we should unite as a species, as humans, beyond boundaries, beyond religions, beyond any sort of particular beliefs or who you like for your football team or basketball team, but as a species defending life, because that's the most precious thing we have. And you know what? This is our home. This planet is the one we're going to be stuck with for a very, very long time. And to me, that's another call for arms. You know, humans unite and protect what we have. And that's a spiritual call, too, to be connected in a deep sense with humanity and with the planet that we inhabit.
Well, that's well said. Well said, indeed. Tell me about the book, A Tear at the Edge of Creation. It's out there now?
It's out there now. It came out in the beginning of April. It's already in 7 languages, which makes me very, very happy. And in fact, in my native Brazil, it's been in a bestseller list for about, 4 or 5 weeks now. And here it's beginning, you know, it's beginning the climb. I always say there are lots of voices out there trying to be heard, but I hope that this message that I'm bringing, which is, yes, it's about science, but it's a science with a heart, and there is a spiritual notion very deep at the very core of this book, is going to make people say, okay, this is not just any old science book talking about what a superstring is or what a galaxy is, but it's actually a science book that is telling us about what does it mean to be human. And that's quite different.
It sure is. Well, Marcelo, we've got a final hour to go with you. We will open up the phone lines and let our listeners have an opportunity to chat with you and get your views on some of the things they have. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.